Chapter 6 Renfield PLC. The thing about Oscar Menendez, in Mary's opinion, is that he is intelligent, charming, personable, manipulative, and utterly ruthless. He's not a normal workplace sociopath. He is that much more dangerous phenomenon, a not quite neurotypical person who has worked among the regular sociopaths for so long that he can see things from their point of view and manipulate them. A dolphin among sharks. Sociopaths aren't good at impulse control or deferred gratification. Oscar works out what they want, dangles it in front of them like a shiny bauble in front of a kitten, and ensures that the shortest route from predator to prize takes them right where he wants them to go. Which is why the bank gave him, if not carte blanche, then at least a clean sheet and a low 7-digit budget with which to establish the scrum. It has been a pleasure to work with him, and to help steer the scrum around the worst obstacles in its path. And now she's going to accompany him to a meeting with their overseers, where he is going to try and talk them into giving the scrum a slightly larger pot to play with. He's assigned her the job of covering the exits, lest any of the cattle try to flee. It has been an interesting month since Alex's accidental flash of insight, and their subsequent week-long scramble to research and define the potentials and pitfalls of their new condition. Mary has been working 80-hour weeks, and she's not alone. Not that there's anyone waiting back home for her since Alan fucked off last year. Or, if you want to be truthful, since she fired him for being an insufficiently supportive partner. Oscar is similarly, if not single, then moderately unencumbered. His wife Pippa seems content to play the role of arm candy on demand, keep their two children out of his hair, and look after the house in return for her annual Mercedes SLC and the Royal Opera House season ticket. As the managerial side of the scrum, they've barely been out of each other's presence for the past few weeks as they organised the office move, pushed their people through the planning and early execution stages of what they have come to call the big pivot, arranged the tiresome but entirely necessary in-house dental visits for the team, and attended to all the other necessary minutiae of the operation. And now it's time for Oscar's big pitch.
Good evening, Sam, Steph, Ari, and thank you for making time in your crowded schedule, Sir David.
Oscar rolls into his warm-up, while Mary waits at one side of the table, within easy grabbing distance of the laptop and the projector, playing the glamorous assistant to Oscar's stage magician.
This isn't a routine report, you'll be pleased to hear. 5 weeks ago, one of our theoreticians made a conceptual breakthrough, and I decided to put regular work on hold for a week while we explored its potential to revolutionize our operations. I don't use that word lightly, and I wouldn't have pulled my entire team off their normal workload if the value proposition represented by the new paradigm wasn't extreme, with a payback curve that will reach break-even within a single quarter. However, to continue in this new direction, I need to confirm that all stakeholders are fully invested. Basically, gentlemen and lady, I need your consent to pivot the scrum.
Mary strokes the remote lighting controller that she holds out of sight behind her back. She's been dimming the meeting room lights slowly since the four senior execs arrived, taking her cue from Oscar. She's got no idea how he managed to winkle Sir David out of his oak-panelled penthouse nest, but he's a prize. The bank's director of quantitative trading. The others are all lower-level executives, from the head of the London Stock Exchange IT group to the Lord, or rather Lady High Executioner of the regulatory compliance team. But they're all critically important, because any one of them can spike Oscar's attempt to change his team's operation remit if they withhold their consent. Furthermore, they're already beginning to look uneasy at what Oscar is telling them.
We will be able to anticipate major trading strategy shifts among the quant-determined strategies of our rival institutions. This is medium-term stuff, a 1 to 10 day lead, but with this fantastic new algorithmic approach, we should be able to consistently anticipate the commodities markets. Ironically, the worst drawback is that it's so good, it'll look eerily like front-running to an outsider, and we don't want to lay ourselves open to accusations of malfeasance. So, we intend to bulletproof ourselves from a regulatory perspective before we go any further, which is why I invited you all here today.
What Oscar and Mary have in mind is not front-running.
Front-running is the practice of executing your own trades on the basis of information about pending trades your clients have told you to perform on their behalf, a form of insider trading. But it's not insider trading if you gaze into the eyes of your opposite number from a rival brokerage or investment bank over an after-work cocktail, calmly order them to adopt a specific spread the next day, and then tell them to forget the conversation ever took place. It's almost certainly illegal, but vampiric mind control is much harder to prove than front-running. For their part, Oscar and Mary are happy to leave the question of which laws, if any, have been broken, to the eventual SFO investigation, because by the time it happens, they intend to be over the horizon and far away. Oscar's voice is intense but somehow mellow and pleasing to the ear. He's a hypnotic speaker, and Mary is pleased to see that his small audience is nodding along with him in perfect harmony. I need access to a trading fund with an initial 100 points of liquidity. A point is £1 million sterling. I'll need to liaise with you, Steph, about setting up appropriate accounting and oversight controls on the new fund, with full record keeping so that it's clear that we're perfectly clean, that we're genuinely anticipating market movements. Ari, to minimize latency, I need to move my group further into the bunker. The basement levels below the bank, windowless subterranean vaults full of servers and roaring air conditioning. And, Sir David, I thought it would be best to keep you in the loop on this, because the profits this pivot will generate will show up on the company-wide balance sheet by Q1 next year at the latest, and you'll want to be fully informed ahead of the next AGM. Oscar smiles, almost, but not quite, bearing his new and very expensive dental work. Mary runs her tongue around the inside of her upper jaw in unconscious sympathy. It's still sore, and they're very tender, but at least her teeth won't raise any awkward questions if she's seen in public.
"Thank you, Oscar," says Sir David. "But you haven't told us exactly what this new breakthrough is yet. Would you like to elaborate?"
Sir David is a distinguished-looking gentleman in his mid-60s, grey-haired and sober-looking, every inch a traditional British bank manager. That's one of the reasons the board keeps him on, to be wheeled out at press conferences when the unwashed proles need reassuring that everything is fine. Right now he looks, if not alarmed, then at least mildly perplexed. Mary shivers and fixes her gaze on his collar, avoiding eye contact, also avoiding staring at the blood vessels in his neck, through which surges and hisses the stuff of...
"A fundamental new insight in probability theory," Oscar says smoothly. "Our existing strategies rely on Bayesian reasoning, which allows us to compute the probability of some event occurring in a given period on the basis of how frequently it has taken place in the past. That's all very well. But where no prior probabilities can be calculated, we can't predict future outcomes. Or at least, that's the way it's been in the past. Finding a way of reasoning under conditions of prior uncertainty has been the holy grail in one particular branch of mathematics for decades, like solving Fermat's last theorem. I'm pleased to say," he smiles and shrugs, "well, that would be telling."
Mary flexes her fingers longingly. Then she startles, infinitesimally aware that one of the other audience members is in the process of noticing her staring. So she smiles, tight-lipped, very glad that English girls are taught not to bare their teeth like Americans. It's a sign of aggression. And glances around the room, registering that Sir David is gazing at Oscar as if hypnotized, his mouth slack. Oscar is laying the charisma on hard, perhaps too hard. She intervenes.
"We've verified the formal proof," she says smoothly. "That's what took us a no-holds-barred 2-week hiatus in our normal workflow. I'd like to remind you that the Scrum has some of the best pure mathematics PhDs to come out of the Russell Group in the past decade. The lads are a little eccentric, but basically sound. Naturally, they're a little miffed about not being able to publish and claim their Fields Medal right away, but they put the interest of the organization ahead of their own personal fame, which is why we're eager to give them the opportunity to earn a bonus that will put the Nobel Prize money to shame."
The latter is strictly irrelevant. There's no Nobel Prize for mathematics, but she's not sure her audience have heard of the Fields Medal, and she wants to implant the idea. 7-digit bonuses all round. Oscar nods, his expression pinched and intense, and relaxes his grip on Sir David's grey matter infinitesimally. Sir David twitches, then shuffles himself upright in his chair.
"Capital idea!" he announces. "Yes, if you'd be so good as to forward me a copy of the presentation, along with a memo detailing your requirements, I'll push it forward. Stephanie, please give Mr. Menendez everything he wants, as a matter of urgency. You too, Mr. MacAndrew. If the scrum requires hosting in the middle of the LSE interconnect, give it to them. Whatever it takes."
He stands, implicitly bringing the meeting to an end. If smiles were luminous, his beaming approval could power a small solar farm. The executives stagger out into the corridor, blinking and uncoordinated, like excessively well-tailored zombies. "So," Oscar finally cracks a grin. "How did I do?" Mary takes his arm conspiratorially.
"You did brilliantly," she swallows. "I thought you were laying it on a bit thick towards the end, which is why I jumped in, but it seems to have worked."
"Yes, I can barely believe it. It's not every day I ask for 100 points on a plate, much less get it, no questions asked. But I could feel them." He rubs his throat. "I'm really thirsty."
"Me too."
She lets go of his arm, intrigued by his carefully controlled non-reaction.
"It's 5:45. How about we go for a drink after we shut up shop?"
"I'd like that." He grins again, this time catching her eye. "I'd like that a lot."
"Dude, you just Renfielded our reporting chain all the way up to board level."
"Epic win. Achievement unlocked."
"Piss off home, Evan,"
Mary says wearily. She's been working since 6 a.m, and it's nearly 7 p.m. They've just moved into the scrum's new office on the 3rd subsurface floor of the bank, and the rough edges still show. The ceiling isn't finished, and a couple of missing floor tiles are surrounded by cones and yellow hazard tape to show where the trolls are still working on the wiring runs by day. There are fresh scars on the walls, and a cloying stench of fresh emulsion paint. But it's theirs, and it's safe. There are no windows, the doors lock on the inside, and there are other extras that make it a suitable bolt hole for a nest of vampires. The specially installed fire escape opens directly into the garage, and there's a shiny black Mercedes van with mirrored windows parked next to the crash door. Oscar bought it, and Evan promptly dubbed it the Mystery Machine. It's fueled and boasts features such as a minibar fully stocked with 20 mils type O Scooby snacks, and a couple of discreetly hidden sets of false number plates. The keys are in the ignition, and the sat-nav is loaded with routes to a bolt hole in the country. If a Van Helsing wannabe comes at them through the bank lobby, the scrum can get clear in under 30 seconds.
"I'll go home after..."
Evan is juggling a set of luminous green furry dice. "Sunset, thanks."
10 minutes,
Oscar warns. The office is already semi-empty. Alex has long since sloped away into the deep underground by tube train. Janice is molesting a server somewhere off-site, and the remaining pigs are oinking away happily in the old office upstairs, anticipating another shit-faced evening at a club, where discreet activities involving syringes in toilet cubicles will raise no more eyebrows than usual. Obtaining a supply of cannuli and sample tubes was easy enough. There's a small chemist's in Stratford, where the pharmacist is convinced that the supplies she's ordering for the phlebotomist at the local clinic are entirely legit. Teaching the pigs to use them properly was the hard part. Alex still feels faint at the sight of blood, although he's getting better. But it took actual threats of bodily violence, accompanied by a brisk lecture on hitherto unconsidered aspects of forensic dentistry, to convince Dick not to use his teeth.
"I can tell when I'm not wanted,"
Evan snarks. He lets the dice fall as they will, then collects his briefcase and heads for the door.
"Don't do anything I wouldn't do, okay?"
"Don't let the doorknob hit you on the way out," Oscar mouths silently as he leaves. Mary glances at him. Oscar shares a guilty expression of complicity with her. "You didn't hear me think that, did you?"
"Think what?"
Their eyes meet. A secret smile is exchanged.
"I'm famished. How about you?"
"I could really do with a post-work drink."
Oscar sounds as tired as she feels, Mary realizes. He loosens the knot of his tie, then sits down in one of the pig's chairs, slumps bonelessly, and turns to face the door. Mary picks up a phone terminal.
Janitorial, please. Cleaning service for suite B314. Yes? Right now, thank you very much.
She hangs up.
Cleaner's on her way.
Thank you. You're brilliant.
Behind his head, out of his line of sight, Mary smiles contentedly.
I know, she thinks. Story of my life. I'm brilliant, and nobody gives a shit.
Well, that isn't entirely true. She's here, working inside the most exciting in-house startup this city has ever incubated, and she's part of it. One of the nighttime elite, one of the masters of the universe if Oscar's plan comes to fruition. And it will work. Mary knows this for a fact. She's been steering Oscar away from certain unfortunate ideas that might draw them to the attention of people she can't talk about. Through long force of habit, Mary's thoughts skitter away from that aspect of her prehistory, dead and buried and bound in any case to silence under the grave. Over the years, it has become easy for her to avoid thinking about the people she used to work for, as a lowly admin body in a civil service niche role with no prospects. It's not hard to avoid the bad memories, crap housing, an infuriatingly obtuse boyfriend who couldn't get a clue if she whacked him between the eyes with it, not enough money. Not to mention the eventual bust-up, although frankly ditching him had been for the best in the long run. It's even easier to avoid recalling the embarrassing interview in which HR had carpeted her, suggesting more in sorrow than in anger that perhaps in view of her personal relationships she would like to be released, might find life more fulfilling on the outside. But then there was the other interview they'd arranged with the bank, which turned out far better than she could ever have imagined.
Oh yes, I'm brilliant. But soon they won't be able to ignore me any more. So I'll have to be at least one step ahead of them, won't I? She adds.
There's a timid knock on the outside door. The security airlock and Faraday wallpaper aren't finished yet. Then it opens to admit a cleaning cart and a person of no account.
Meals on wheels,
Mary murmurs, laying her hand on Oscar's shoulder. His muscles tense under her fingers.
Excuse?
The cleaner is middle-aged, a recent immigrant with poor English. She's a regular, they've had her before, but she's still surprised as if it's her first time.
Don't be afraid. There's nothing to worry about.
Oscar stands and moves aside, gesturing at his just-vacated chair.
You're feeling tired. Why don't you sit down?
Excuse?
She shakily shuffles towards him, bovine puzzlement lending her an air of geriatric confusion.
Sit. Down.
Oscar points. Mary steps out from behind the chair, keeping her expression calm and unthreatening.
You are very tired. You can relax here. You are among friends. You can sleep if you like.
Oscar keeps his hands in motion like small birds, fluttering delicately. He studied stagecraft when he was younger, NLP and other approaches to mind manipulation when he was older. It's magic, of a kind, although Mary is aware of much more powerful varieties, types of magic that constitute a science rather than an art. She keeps a careful grip on her handbag. It's a neat black leather number that matches her suit. She keeps the medical supplies inside it.
It's all right to close your eyes,
Mary assures the woman.
What's your name?
Sarah?
Sarah, we know you've had a hard day, but you can close your eyes now. It's nearly over. You can go home soon. Why not take a nap?
There are two of them, and one middle-aged woman of Somali origin whose palsied hands twitch as they force their combined willpower down on her like warm, stifling pillows. They've used her before. There is no seduction here, just a brisk 60-second interlude, at the end of which Sarah slumps, snoring very quietly in the expensive office chair. Oscar bends over her and begins to roll up one of her sleeves.
Hang on, better use the right arm this time, Mary suggests. Otherwise we're going to leave tracks.
And it really wouldn't do to attract the wrong kind of attention, the laundry kind.
Right.
Oscar carefully rearranges her clothing and switches arms.
She doesn't seem well, he adds, mildly concerned. Did you notice that?
The shaking? Yes.
Mary assembles the cannula, sample tubes, and tourniquet in silent concentration.
I don't see how it matters.
That's the second one I've seen, Oscar says almost absent-mindedly.
Second what?
The second subject, with the shakes.
There's probably a bug doing the rounds,
Mary reassures him as she slides the needle in, searching for a vein. She grits her teeth and suppresses a shudder of erotic longing as the first sample tube begins to fill with blue-tinged venous blood.
Does it make you wet?
Oscar asks abruptly. Mary stares at him over their sleeping donor's head, then glances in the direction of his crotch. It's a moment she's been anticipating for weeks, the crossing of a delicious Rubicon.
Does it give you a hard-on? She replies.
She meets his gaze directly, then smiles and pulls back her lips so that he can see what they conceal. The pulse in his throat is fast.
What took you so long? She wonders. It's better than sex.
She shivers. I wouldn't know, Oscar says slowly. I haven't compared it directly to sex with one of our kind. Have you noticed that humans are less interesting these days?
Wait.
Mary forces herself to focus on the syringe.
Actually, yes, I have. Take this.
She swaps out the sample tube and passes him the full one.
Sorry, where were we? Do you mean to follow through, or are you going to chicken out?
We were discussing...
He's married. Probably hasn't propositioned anyone in years. Scared of harassment lawsuits and the bill for the divorce settlement. Do I always have to do the heavy lifting? My place or yours?
I was thinking in terms of a hotel. But first... He raises the tube. A toast. To health, life, and wealth. After they relieve Sarah the cleaner of approximately 100 milliliters of blood, a third of a unit, so little that she'll barely notice it, Mary and Oscar leave her sleeping soundly in Oscar's chair and head for the car park. Discreet decorum is observed until they're behind the tinted windows of Oscar's Panamera. Then they lean shoulder to shoulder and exchange a kiss, tainted with a new and breathtaking scent that makes them both shudder, from which moment it runs forward as if on rails. Oscar's self-restraint is superhuman. He imposes it on Mary, even though she's shaking slightly with anticipation. He stays outwardly calm and collected as he drives into Mayfair, drops the keys in a valet's hand, walks up to the front desk at Claridge's and says, "I'd like the best suite you've got for the night." Mary tumbles along in his wake, trying to hold herself together.
"I'm melting," she thinks.
Something in the blood has gotten to her. Then the door on one of the Lindley suites closes behind them, and he turns to face her, and the frenzied animals come out. About 2 hours later, tired and raw and sticky, Mary comes to in the middle of the wreckage of a king-sized bed. She's almost but not entirely naked. Oscar turned out to be a stockings man. He's naked too, lying on his back, snoring. She reaches out and wraps one hand possessively around his still erect cock. She's been working towards this moment for weeks. Happily, it turned out to be much more fun than she'd expected. The snore turns to a groan, and as he pulls away, she notices that his penis is redder than the rest of his skin.
Is that blood? She wonders. Or is he sore?
She, too, aches, but she enjoyed getting there. She's thirsty again, she realizes.
Hey, big boy.
She punches him gently in the side.
Wake up.
He opens his eyes and stares at her. If she'd been dressed, his look would make her feel naked. As it is, it makes her feel stripped to the bone. It's a predator's expression, innocent and deadly. Then he spoils it by cracking a dazed schoolboy smile. That was wild. Mary is about to glare at him in disappointment, but he recovers his poise within a couple of seconds. I would kill for a drink. He rolls on his side. And I need a shower. How about you?
There are a couple of shots of blood in my bag. We can hit room service for food.
Shower first? She strips off her stockings, and they move into the living room of the suite. Ignore the dressing table set with a welcome bottle of Laurent Perrier champagne,
and head straight to the marble bathroom with its huge walk-in shower and whirlpool bath. There's room for two in the shower. That was something else going on, she murmurs thoughtfully, as he rubs soapy water across her skin. She can feel every square millimetre. She's acutely, preternaturally sensitive. It's a smell of... He kisses her shoulder. The red stuff. Mary shudders and closes her eyes. It's true. If drinking blood is an erotic experience, then sex under the influence is like... She fails to think of a suitable simile. Coke doesn't even come close. The impulse to push him against the wall and fuck him in the shower is almost overpowering, despite the aches. It's addictive, she says finally. Yes, which is problematic. The icy chill of his intellect is returning. There isn't very much of the little boy left in Oscar. He didn't get to his position without being able to keep it under very tight control. He's not one for casual workplace flings, which makes her triumph all the sweeter. Because, yes, we need it, which is a weakness. You're thinking of the pawns, she leans against him. Yes, I'm not planning to ditch them, he adds carefully. Not yet. Not unless they become a liability. She turns inside his arms and begins to massage his shoulders and spine with the soap. Their lips meet briefly. Am I a liability, Oscar? You're not a pawn. A queen, maybe. His penis, he's 40 and he hasn't gone soft. Amazing. Pushes gently against the side of her thigh. You understand the value of keeping secrets. She wraps one hand around his balls, feeling them tighten as she strokes. I've had a lot of practice, she says, before she can think to censor herself. Then she realizes something else. Oh, that's odd. What is? He's instantly alert, sensitive to her perturbation. I'm not supposed to be able to talk about it. She leans against him and kisses him greedily to shut him up, covering her faux pas. But it's too much fun. One thing leads to another, and she moans and bites his shoulder as he slides inside her again. Blood. But it tastes wrong. There's nothing sexy about Oscar's circulatory fluid. He's biting her now, then pulling away, disappointed. They continue to fuck, but the magic is leaking out of it, swirling down the shower drain with a thin red trail of soap suds. It's just ordinary mammalian humping. Enjoyable, but nothing to set her hair on fire and make her scream until the windows explode. And Oscar feels it too, because after a minute he stops and slides away, slowly detumescing. Back in the bedroom, Mary rummages through the discarded bedding for her handbag. The four remaining sample tubes are fine. She pulls a couple and holds one out to Oscar. As he takes it, she pops the lid on her own and raises it.
You're... Hang on, this is skunked.
Her nose wrinkles in disgust. She examines the tube closely.
It smells wrong.
Oscar unseals his and takes a sip. His expression of distaste speaks volumes. Want to try the others? It takes Mary less than a minute to determine that all the other sample tubes are spoiled. Not clotted or rotten. Whatever previously made the contents so enticing has vanished, leaving only rancid red meat juice behind.
This hasn't happened before, she observes.
Well, we'll just have to hit room service, won't we? Oscar towels himself dry. For food and drink. He watches with detached amusement as Mary collects her scattered clothes. Unless you'd like to dine out.
I didn't bring my glad rags. Room service will do just fine.
She goes in search of the room service directory as Oscar begins to dress. Later, over Kobe steaks flown in from Osaka that morning, with discreet tubes of blood donated by the bellhop as a digestive, Oscar asks her the question she's been worrying about. What exactly aren't you supposed to talk about? He asks.
I can talk, Mary realizes, surprised. Before the bank, I worked for a rather secret division of the civil service. I was allowed to leave, classified as a liability. Allowed to transition to the private sector, but they have these brainwashing-like capabilities that operate like our ability to, you know, that make it impossible to talk about what you did there without their permission, and I was obviously not able to talk about them before.
Her head spinning. I shouldn't be able to say this stuff, she tells herself. How can I say this stuff? The Gesh, does vampirism defeat it?
What? Oscar looks puzzled. What sort of stuff did they do?
Her fork pauses, a blood-tinted slice of rare steak impaled upon the moment of the present.
They're the branch of the Secret Intelligence Service that deals with occult threats, like us.
They're the... Oscar stops. No, I'm not going to say you're crazy.
He chuckles briefly, then a dyspeptic frown steals all sign of amusement from his face.
We're fucking vampires. Of course there's going to be a government department. It's in the rules.
He peers at her intently. What did you do for this agency?
Admin and management. HR dog's body.
She resumes eating, feeling her pulse slow towards normality again.
I saw, something I shouldn't have when I was at university. They've got a habit of picking up witnesses and finding make-work for them to keep them under observation for a while. Sometimes for life. I was there for 3 or 4 years. God, it was tedious. Eventually, they figured I wasn't a practitioner, and they could let me go under a compulsion to keep my trap shut. They even sorted out a bunch of job interviews for me. There's a standard exit procedure.
You said practitioner. You mean we're muggles? Something like that?
Oscar and Pippa have spawned, so they've clearly been exposed to the Harry Potter virus along the way. Mary frowns minutely.
It doesn't work quite like that.
She thinks for a moment.
There's not a huge gap between what their practitioners do and what our pigs get up to. They have a saying, magic is a branch of applied mathematics.
Her eyes widen as she drops her fork.
Oh, shit. Excuse me.
She covers her mouth.
Oh, shit, indeed.
Oscar takes a deep breath.
Well, that changes a lot of things.
Why didn't you tell me earlier?
Because I couldn't. I didn't know I could talk about it.
Her barely exaggerated distress is sufficiently obvious that Oscar feels compelled to do the gentlemanly thing, offering her a linen napkin to use as a tissue. She dabs at her eyes, then pushes her plate away.
I don't feel hungry. I feel stupid.
Our ability to control ordinary people's minds doesn't affect one another, Oscar notes. If this organization's grip on you works the same way...
That would explain everything.
She reaches for her tube of sang de sommelier and knocks it back in a desperate shot.
Oh, this stuff helps me think. Isn't that stupid? It makes everything clearer.
She stares at Oscar across the ruins of dinner.
I've been trying to steer you away from doing anything that I thought would attract their attention, but I'm pretty sure they're going to come for us sooner or later. I've been working on a plan, but being able to tell you about them will make things much easier.
She takes a deep breath.
What we did with the board, think of it as a dress rehearsal. The stakes next time will be much sharper.
Then we'll just have to be ready for them, won't we? At least we'll be forewarned and forearmed when your men in black pay us a call.
Oscar very deliberately raises the other tube to his lips, uncaps it, and swallows. He shudders very slightly as he puts it down and focuses on her. But first... They don't even make it to the bedroom this time. Sarah's body reclines in Oscar's chair, slowly cooling, for nearly 3 hours after his and Mary's departure. That's how long it takes for her supervisor, annoyed by her failure to report back, to go searching for her. Ava, the supervisor, is so wrapped up in her own timekeeping concerns that she angrily hectors Sarah's body for nearly 30 seconds, before she becomes concerned at the corpse's lack of response and tries to wake her. The ambulance crew arrive to take her away at 1 in the morning. The cleaning service's duty manager arrives to give the upset supervisor a talking to 30 minutes after that, but he reluctantly concedes that there's more to this business than meets the eye. The cleaning services company has no alternative but to recognize that 3 employees have died on the job this month, in this particular client's office, working nights, and while once is happenstance,
and twice might be coincidence, three times is sick building syndrome. A memo is prepared for circulation the next day, and gears begin to turn.